Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by talking about the 13 million children who live in poverty in the United States. That is nearly one in six children. Almost half of them live in extreme poverty, according to the Children's Defense Fund. Children are considered poor if they live in a family with an annual income below about $25,000 for a family of four. That amounts to almost $500 a week or $70 a day. Nearly one in three Black, one in three Native American, and one in four Latino children are poor, compared with one in 11 white children. Poor children are more likely to have poor academic achievement, drop out of high school, and later become unemployed, also experience economic hardship, and might be involved in the criminal system. In the new Frontline documentary, Growing Up Poor in America, today's guest, Jezza Newman, introduces us to three families in Ohio. They go to food banks hoping to find strawberries. They miss bills and have their electricity cut. They don't have enough money to pay for their storage unit, and so their things are auctioned off, and they dream about the future. You can watch the trailer for Growing Up Poor in America at yourcallradio.org. And I think we have that trailer. Can we play that trailer?
She's doing good. She's doing really good. I just love her.
With being back, just kind of nervous and hoping and praying that we don't get shut back down because of this pandemic. For right now, I'm taking it one day at a time and just saving, you know, as much as I can.
There's way more kids like this is going through the same thing as we are, because sometimes life just happens.
Sorry about that. We are all in different places right now because of COVID, and I think we got our clips mixed up. You can find the trailer at yourcallradio.org, and we will play that clip a little later in the show. The film airs on Tuesday, September 8th. Jezza Newman is an award-winning documentary filmmaker and co-producer of Growing Up Poor in America. Hi, Jezza. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. You have been making documentaries about poverty, about poor children, and people on the margins of society for more than a decade. I mean, we are seeing inequality widen. It's widened before COVID, but COVID has made it even worse. What are your overall thoughts about media coverage of poverty in the United States?
Well, I think in general, obviously, a lot of people have preconceptions about poverty, and often, you know, the face of poverty is still portrayed as something that's Dickensian and somebody, you know, without any shoes, living in a mud hut somewhere. The reality is poverty is also, you know, extremely prevalent, even in families that work. And I think that that's where we're seeing more and more families who are actually what we call the working poor, you know. And that this is why I think that, you know, the divide is growing, and why in America, you know, you're kind of losing. There's a lot of talk about losing that middle class because of the divide. And I think that's just because, you know, wages, cost of living isn't keeping up with, you know, wages aren't keeping up with cost of living. And so you'll see it's very common to meet a family where a parent or both parents are working, yet they're still requiring food stamps. So I think that, you know, the modern face of poverty is probably closer to what you would envisage, you know, would be okay, that these families would be fine. If you see any of the families in the film, they don't portray what your image of poverty is.
You know, it's so true. And when one of the families was going to the food bank, and the daughter was saying, I hope they have strawberries this time around. They were borrowing a friend's car. And I remember in the beginning of COVID when we saw the very long lines, I mean, miles long lines at food banks. You know, some people on social media said, look at all those nice cars. Well, the fact is you could either borrow a car or still have a nice car and be living in poverty for who knows, you know, for a number of reasons.
Oh, yes. And, you know, we experienced, you know, I've been on the ground in Ohio in all parts of Ohio. So I've been, you know, down in Southeast, I've been in Columbus, I've been, and we've been to a lot of food drives, a lot of food banks. We've been to larger distributions, and time again, we hear about, oh, well, we're a family, we're seven families. We're like, what do you mean, seven families? Well, I'm here and I've brought my neighbor, and I'm collecting for an elderly neighbor who's too scared to come out. I'm collecting. So every car you see isn't necessarily just one family either. That could be two families, three families. So there's been a real sort of and that's one of the nice things that I've seen is this community spirit through COVID of pulling together. But it's not uncommon that those cars will contain more than one family.
Right. You know, we have the Poor People's Campaign in the United States, which is led by William Barber, and they're doing really incredible work. All of the Democratic presidential candidates came to speak to them, and they said, will you please have a forum on poverty? And yet you hear about the middle class over and over again from all politicians, but they rarely talk about poverty. Why do you think that is?
I think it's a tough subject. You know, I think that obviously it's one of those issues that really needs a sustainable program to tackle it that goes beyond the next election. And I think that's true for other countries. It's not just an American phenomenon. You know, in the UK, it's the same. It's about finding leaders who are prepared to look at actually eradicating poverty over, you know, 10 years, 15 years, not in the next 2 years. You know, throwing in a quick fix is just putting an elastoplast on a gaping wound, you know. And I think that's part of the problem is that it's a hard issue to talk about because it does involve putting things in place that will last over time. Because it's about, you know, how do you get to inner city America or to the rural regions of America where kids might not even have internet? You know, how do you tell them they can be a doctor, they can be a journalist, you know, right, when they, you know, are barely even managing to get to school? And I think that's the issue. It's how do we create the opportunity for people to gain, you know, social mobility?
Well, and that's the other question is there's a reason why this is happening when you look at policies. I mean, the Children's Defense Fund, which focuses specifically on poverty, they're constantly talking about the kinds of government policies that would actually help the families that you focus on in your documentary.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of, you know, good programs, good ideas, good ways to invest in it. It's just about, again, like I say, it's finding, you know, implementing them and making them sustainable.
Right. So talk about how you actually find families, because you spend a lot of time with them. They allow you into their homes in their most private moments, in their bedrooms, in their front rooms. I mean, talk about that process. How do you find the families and then gain their trust?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so we start by sort of getting to know the community I'm in. So the first couple of weeks I spend anywhere, I'll go and meet people who work in education, people, you know, so I'll go and visit schools. I'll go to food pantries. I'll go to any support services there might be for youth, after school clubs, things like this. So And really get and talk to as many people. You know, you can quickly find out sort of who in the community are the sort of players in this and who are doing different things. And you go and chat to them and bring them on board and make sure they understand who we are and what we're trying to achieve. And then gradually it gets to the point that literally we will go to food pantries and stand there and talk to people, and we'll just ask them, you know, we're making this documentary, are you open to talking to us a little bit? If they are, then we say, look, we could either do it now after you've collected your food, or if it's more convenient, we could come and see you at a later date. And, you know, obviously, ideally, you get to speak to them there and then, because if they say they'll speak to you later, then their lives are chaotic. Their lives, you know, are already in crisis. So then to remember to call us to then meet to talk about this thing doesn't happen so often. So really it's about us, me and the team, spending time on the ground in the food pantries trying to talk to people. And then once you do find a family that's open to talking to you, it's then about just taking it easy. And I tell all the families, look, you don't know what this is like. You know, you don't know what it'll be like to have us there with a camera. Sometimes I'll just sit there and observe. I won't necessarily ask questions or do things, and it might seem a little bit odd to you. So it's just about, look, we'll take it easy. And if you decide that you, it's not for you, then that's fine. I'll walk away and all the footage will end up in the trash. So it's just step by step, slowly, slowly, and spending time with the families and not always turning over, you know, not always putting the camera on, sometimes just being there a bit and listening to some of the things they want to talk about, even if they're not relevant to the story you're telling, you know. So, yeah, it's kind of, I mean, I always say, look, when you first meet someone, you know, a friend introduces you to a friend, they're not going to become your best friends overnight. Yeah, you spend time together, you build trust. It's very similar with filmmaking. You know, it's about building that trust where they believe. Obviously, I have made films in the past. So I, you know, people are very media savvy now, and they're much more media savvy than when I started out. And they're much more aware of, you know, and social media is much more prevalent. So it's very easy for them to find out who I am and what I've done before. So, you know, I'll give them links to say, look, just watch this film. And I don't want to make that film. This is new. This is different. This is you. But if you want to get an idea for how I handle your story and portray families in these situations, at least it gives you an idea. So it's just finding different ways of building that trust and building that relationship. And sometimes I have had it where, you know, a family have decided after a while, it's not for that, you know, they don't want to do it anymore. You know, something's changed in their life that means that, you know, it's not going to be right to put this on television. And so we have to walk away, you know, and you have to be prepared for that.
And I also, your style is very interesting. You basically bring us into their homes. It's not like you have, you know, so-called experts in there or politicians in there. It's just the families. And it's almost like we're just sort of watching them live, watching everyday life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, it's about bringing the human side of the statistics. You know, there are other experts out there who will tell you every stat you want to know about numbers of in poverty, what finance is put in there. So I see my role very much about bringing the human side of this to you in the best way possible. And so for me, in my heart, it's about observational filming, which is why there's a scene in the film where Sean learns of some news about a teacher. And I was just sat in the corner of his bedroom with the camera running. I had no idea what was coming, you know. And it's just having that, you know, having that, telling yourself that it's fine, just follow your instinct, just be there with them. And, you know, I have days of filming that, you know, nothing happened. You know, Dior might have cried a bit, Sean might have got on his mother's nerves, but, you know, there would have been some happy times. And, but you have to accept that, you know, you have to be prepared to put in the time. And the other thing is just, you might go into a day going to film something thinking this is what you're going to do, but be prepared to actually do something completely differently. And that's something I often tell people when they're trying to start out in filmmaking is, you know, it's very easy to go in with a perceived idea of what you want to get and then be blinkered to everything else that's going on around you. So that's what we try to do. That's why the team's very small. You know, any shooter go on, I'd only ever have, say, Lauren with me, or if it was in Cincinnati, I'd have Maddie or Brooke, you know, but it'd always be just the two of us. I'd never make it a bigger team than that, unless we were at a food pantry meeting families, and then there might be three of us.
Today, we're speaking with Jezza Newman, an award-winning documentary filmmaker and co-producer of the new Frontline documentary, Growing Up Poor in America. You can see the trailer at yourcallradio.org. The film airs on Tuesday, September 8th. So, Jezza, let's talk about some of the families you filmed. You mentioned Sean. Sean lives in a trailer with his mom, Crystal, and baby sister. His brother lives with their grandparents. Learning about Sean and his mom, I thought this was really interesting because they get about $485 per month in assistance and $400 in food stamps. So that's about $10,600 for the entire year for a family of three. And Crystal actually has to work for the assistance that she's getting. She works at the Salvation Army. She puts free food boxes in people's cars. And she has kidney disease, and her doctor said she shouldn't be working.
She did have kidney disease. That then is in remission, so that's why she's now able to work the hours. But yes, many people who are receiving benefits actually have to work for those benefits, and they're given an assignment in the community. It's just very lucky for Crystal that the assignment she was given was it where she lives, so she's able to walk there because she doesn't have a car at all, not even one to borrow off a friend. Although her mother and father have one, so they're able to drive her on occasion. But most of the time, she's without a car. So luckily, her assignment is in the plains, and yes, she has to do, I think it's 86 hours to cover that.
It was also really striking, since they don't have a car, they had to walk to Sean's school to pick up a laptop so he can do his schoolwork, whereas all the families were driving in. They had to be socially distant because of COVID, and they're walking with the stroller in the rain. It seemed like it was lightly raining to pick up his computer.
Yeah, I can confirm it was definitely lightly raining, which made filming trickier. But yeah, it was, to me, that was a sort of that really showed poverty in America to me. When you see a mother stood between a big truck and an SUV to collect a laptop, I think every American sort of sees a car as their left arm, you know, if they had two, you know, it's almost like everybody has cars. And so, yeah, they had to collect the laptop without the car. And equally, when she goes to work, she'll drop the kids around at her mother's, and then she'll walk to work. And if she wants to go to the supermarket, she has to either just pick up as much as she can carry with the boys, or she has to arrange for her mother or stepfather to be able to drive her, you know, or if she can get a friend to drive her. And you it's very easy to forget how reliant you are on immediate transportation, you know, how you suddenly go, oh, we've run out of milk, oh, let's just nip down to the shops and get some milk, you know, and you jump in your car, you go and get it, you're back 5 minutes later. Well, when you run out of milk in Crystal's world, and in many people like Crystal, you can't just pop down to the shops, you know, it could be a 20-minute walk, or you've got to find a vehicle. And obviously in rural areas, there isn't the sort of public transport network of big cities like New York or somewhere. You might be able to jump on a bus or a subway, but you know, for her, it's walking if she wants to get it.
Right. You know, the other thing is that the kids in the film clearly have to grow up faster than other kids. I mean, in Sean's case, he's only 13, and he says, you know, I don't want my mom to know when I feel sad, because then she'll feel sad. He talks about the need to release his anger and his stress, so he has a counselor. And then he also says Sean's mom is white, his dad is black, and he's living with his mom. He says that, I think being black might affect my job prospects in the future.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that he's lived enough in the world to, I mean, on the second point first, you know, he's aware of the fact that there is, you know, there can be a degree of racism amongst people in terms of job opportunities and stuff. You know, he qualifies that and says that might not happen, but, you know, it's an awareness, you know, it's something he's aware of. Obviously, with the events that's happened in America, he's become more aware of it than he might have been. But I think that, you know, and that's all part of this process of growing up sooner beyond your years. And I think that this level, what you drew on there too, was the anxieties these children are having about, you know, I'm worried about, you know, if I'm sad, mum will be sad, and she's already got enough on her plate. And if I complain, then that's going to be worse. And at the same time, they have their own worries and fears that they're not able to get to school and see their friends. And this is where I think one of the new unique things about this film is probably the first time that people with money, people who are okay, people who are do fall into that sort of middle class bracket in inverted commas, will be able to relate to these families because of COVID-19. They will have had children at home 24/7. They'll start to feel the strains and stresses of trying to do a job and look after their children. You know, I know myself. I mean, if I had smaller children, luckily my kids are older, so they're sort of self-sufficient, and I'm not there anyway. I'm here, so but I can see why how this connect could be there, because those anxieties are prevalent even with all children. You know, all children will be missing school, and I think that was something that we see through this film as well. Is that school isn't just about an education. It's about children of certain ages mixing with their peers of those ages. And as much as a parent can fill in the gaps to a degree, playing, you know, Lego or online game or whatever it is you choose to do with a bunch of 7-year-olds or 12-year-olds is very different to doing it with a 40-year-old. You know, it's not the same.
Right.
And I think that's really come apparent through this period.
And in the case of Miracle, who is 16, and Lakin, who is 12, I mean, Miracle clearly loves going to school. She was looking forward to her prom. She really wants to be a first-generation college student. She talks about her dreams of wanting to be an elementary school teacher, wanting to live in the suburb and have a happy family. And she says, if it goes wrong, I'll be poor. And you just have to wonder, how will Miracle be able to go to school, given that her mom works at a gas station and their electricity just got disconnected?
Yeah, I mean, this is the issue. This is where help is really needed. You know, it's how do you find, you know, how do you support and make sure there is a sustainable program to support kids like Miracle who want to, you know, create a better life for themselves, you know, because her mom will hold her hands up. And she even says in the film at one point that I can't teach her younger sister, so there's no hope of helping Miracle. Mm. If no one's been to college, how do they know how to fill in application forms and when to fill in forms? And so for Miracle, she was really reliant on the school for that. And now that she can't go, obviously she's having worries and concerns. So for her, it is a problem, you know, it's a very real problem, particularly now, because you need to start applying. And also she's got to get some of her grades up. So, you know, that is always is the sort of the bit that's missing in the puzzle, if you like, is the next stage, because there's a lot of support in schools. But once you leave school, you're kind of on your own.
Right. It also just shows you how a K through college program in this country could really just do so much for these families. If these kids knew that money was not an option, if they just got good grades, and, you know, there were organizations and programs in place to really help them with the process. I mean, imagine Miracle just knowing that she could go to college and money wouldn't be an issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And Kaya, too, who we meet in one of the other stories. She too has dreams of becoming a surgical tech, but whether she'll ever make them, who knows? I mean, she's still 14, so she's not, you know, but she is starting to hit that critical stage in schooling where, you know, your exams matter and your scores matter. So again, yeah, for all these kids, having a program that you knew you through to college, because I mean, I know people say you don't need college to become somebody. Of course you don't. You don't have to. But the reality is when in your area there is nothing, where you're living, there aren't many jobs, you will have to travel to find work. And you'll also need those skill sets. And if you're not getting the skill set, I mean, we take for granted within middle class families the skills we're actually taking from our parents, from our grandparents, from our cousins, because those skill sets, you know, about filling in forms and how to find a way, how to get that job, how to be a bit clever about it, you know. So for someone like Miracle, college is incredibly important because it's also helping her develop those skills and is then around all sorts of people from all sorts of life and from all sorts of areas. So it's also a leveling place. So, and also, you know, the reality is with education is it gives you options. So she may ultimately choose to become, you know, to work at the local gas station. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, her mum does it. But wouldn't it be much nicer that that was her choice for specific reasons than the only job she can get?
Right. I wonder, you're from England?
Yes,
I am. So you come at this from an interesting perspective, because in many European countries, school is either free or much, much cheaper than it is in the United States. So what are your thoughts about that? As someone from England doing these pieces, how do you think about poverty in the United States and these struggles?
Well, I mean, the reality is I think on some levels, there's very similar issues and the fundamental changes that need to take place, you know, cut across. I think obviously in America, it can be much harder to have that social mobility, because I think there's a much larger need for your own transportation, for starters. You know, there's much better public networks in England. But then you're talking about much bigger spaces here, which obviously makes it more difficult. But I think that and then obviously in terms of college, it is technically more reachable in the UK, because obviously it's a lot cheaper. You know, university fees are set at a price that, you know, is nothing like America. But, you know, obviously still for the poorer families, it's still often beyond what their expectations are. So I would say that, you know, probably the hurdles could be slightly harder in America. But you do, sadly, you see, you know, no one's got it right yet. You know, if a country had got it right, then we'd have a model we could all follow. But at the moment, there isn't one.
The other thing that was striking is to see just how hard it is to get out of this hole. For example, in the case of Lakin and Miracle, their mom is behind on bills. You know, Lakin has ADHD. Her mom says, there's no way I can afford extra help for her. And then in the case of Kaya and Kalia, they didn't have enough money to pay for their storage unit. And so some of their very personal things were just auctioned off. I mean, that was very disturbing to learn about.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was interesting that for Kaya, who's the younger sister, you know, when I talked to her about that, it was the photographs that she missed. You know, that was the most gutting thing for her, was losing her photos, her memories. Yeah. It wasn't, you know, the TV set or the bed, or, you know, that was annoying and frustrating and financial. But it's the fact that you're losing, you know, your sort of your history and your past as well, when you lose everything in storage. And I think that and obviously, you know, that's where money can obviously play quite a significant role in terms of, you know, your future and your life in respect to Lakin. Is obviously, if mum could afford a tutor, then things could be very different for her. But, you know, the reality is she needed school. She needed the structure of school. And so when that structure is taken away, she's at a loss. It's not like she's a bad kid. She has ADHD. She has difficulty concentrating. That is something that she has. But if she has the right sort of mechanisms put in place for her to concentrate, then she does. She was doing all right at school. Leave school, it's chaotic. Mum's trying to survive. There's no one there. It's impossible for Miracle to try and force her to do homework. You know, so she goes down to the food pantry and Candy helps her down there for a little while. But even that, she can only help her if Lakin comes, you know. So I think those structures are really important. And if you don't have the money to then put them in place when there's no longer school, then obviously it's going to end up in a slight world of chaos. But
right. Do you stay in touch with these families?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm still in touch with all the kids from my film I made in 2012 and 2017. I still talk to all those children. In fact, 2 weeks ago, I filmed, when I started out in television, I filmed on my first ever documentary was in 1998. And I was a camera person for a director. And one of the kids there, Becky, contacted me 2 weeks ago because she had eventually found us through Facebook and just wanted to contact us and say, you know, how she was doing and that the film was a great moment for her. Because what you find is with these documentaries is that I end up staying in contact with them because we build that relationship of trust, and you can't just dump them after that. And secondly, you know, you try to make the film theirs. They have ownership of it. And therefore, ultimately, they're empowered by it. So you try to make sure that by the end of it, you know, they feel they've accomplished this. This is theirs. They own this film. They were brave enough to speak out and try and put their world out there to help other children like them. And I was the facilitator of that. So, of course, I'm important to them now. And so, of course, I'm not going to just say, well, thanks, done my film, I'm off now. So, yes, I am in contact with many of the kids that I film with over the years.
Well, thank you for your very important work. We'd love to have you back to have a longer conversation about poverty. And thank you for introducing us to these incredible families. We enjoyed watching the film. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. And thanks for highlighting it as well.
Jezza Newman is an award-winning documentary filmmaker and co-producer of Growing Up Poor in America. You can see the trailer at yourcallradio.org and then watch the film on Tuesday, September 8th. Coming up after a break, journalist Katie Engelhart will join us to talk about her investigation about the for-profit nursing home industry in the U.S. and the spread of COVID at the Life Care Center in Kirkland, Washington. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now I would like to welcome Katie Engelhart to the show. Katie has written a very important investigation about the for-profit nursing home industry and the spread of COVID at the Life Care Center in Kirkland, Washington. Katie Engelhart is a reporter and documentary film producer based in New York City. She's also a national fellow at New America. Hi, Katie. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you decide to write such an in-depth, lengthy investigation about what happened at the Life Care Center?
Well, I guess, you know, I had two primary motivations. My first was to really understand, you know, we knew that COVID was spreading through nursing homes at this incredible rate, to really understand what it felt like to be inside a nursing home as a resident during that time. You know, I think nursing home residents tend to be written about and, you know, grouped together as a sort of elderly amorphous population. But of course, these are individuals. They are living in a facility that is their home. They have, you know, personalities and that are as varied as any other demographic group. And I really wanted to try to, you know, honor that and to understand better what they were seeing around them. And of course, you know, There was difficulty in that because a large percentage of the nursing home population has dementia. And that was something I really had to work with, to think about what is it like to see friends die around you, to see nurses become rushed and hysterical when you don't have the full ability to really comprehend, you know, intellectually what's happening. So that was the first part of it. And I think the second part of it was I was really interested by this question of blame. You know, I think the narrative has sort of shifted over the last few months. But, you know, roughly, I think we've heard one camp sort of suggest that what's happening in nursing homes is really the product of biology. We know coronavirus affects elderly populations more seriously. And you know, there's one group of people who say, well, nursing homes were just really, really unlucky. They were hit with this virus and you know, their residents died and they had no control over it. But on the other hand, there's this new narrative that's creeping in that's asking, you know, were individual nursing homes to blame for some of the resident death? Why is it that some nursing homes had, you know, half of the population affected by coronavirus and some weren't affected at all? And this is a conversation that is right now really, really urgent because it's playing out at the state and federal level. The nursing home industry is arguing that it deserves broad immunity from lawsuits related to coronavirus. So they're trying to pass legislation, and in fact, they have in several states, that would prevent families from suing for wrongful death or negligence due to coronavirus. And certainly the industry is also pushing for similar legislation at the federal level. So I was really interested in understanding, you know, to what extent was a facility like the Life Care Center of Kirkland to blame for the deaths there, and to what extent were staff just doing the best they could with what we know is a really unprepared state and country.
How were you able to get such incredible access? Because your piece, if you print it out, is about 49 pages. I mean, you have so much detail in here.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, there wasn't a kind of clear-cut story for me at the beginning. In fact, my editor said something pretty general, like, can you look into what happened at that first nursing home that was hit? Our objective was not to write a 16,000-word piece when we set out. I ended up speaking to about 24 residents, family members, staff members, some of whom spoke to me without, you know, on the request that I didn't use their name. And from there, I sort of saw what the story was. You know, I ended up getting in touch with two women whose mothers were roommates in room number 10 at the Life Care Center and had just wildly different interpretations of what had happened at the nursing home. One woman had her mother pass away in room number 10. The other had her mother survive. And, you know, I thought that by looking at those two stories, I could really get at these different sides of the debate about nursing home culpability.
And just to remind listeners, as of mid-August, 177,129 nursing home residents tested positive for COVID. 45,958 died. This means that nursing home residents account for more than a quarter of total deaths.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's just an absolutely staggering number. And to be fair, we've seen, you know, really high numbers of nursing home deaths in other countries like Canada and Sweden. But I think, you know, there is possibly some danger in just assuming that these deaths were inevitable. And indeed, I found in my piece that, you know, it's not always possible to just dismiss this as, you know, a viral inevitability. I saw that nursing homes have for many years been extremely underregulated, particularly in the area of infection control. And, you know, I think we've seen some of those issues come to roost now. I can give a really specific example of how underregulation affected lives at Kirkland. I found in my reporting, you know, the Life Care Center of Kirkland got hit by COVID near the end of February and was really kind of at the height of chaos in early March. On March 2nd, Life Care's medical director, who was the physician for almost every resident in the facility, came down sick and ended up having to leave work and not come in. And so for 3 days, at the height of this pandemic, when residents are literally dying in their room, there is no doctor at Life Care Center. The facility had no backup doctor and couldn't find any doctor to bring in. The nursing home's been fined for this violation. You know, that was a serious problem. But what I found was it wasn't just a nursing home failure. 3 days into this doctor's absence, officials at the county, state, and federal level knew that there was no doctor inside Life Care and knew that residents were not being, you know, medically assessed by a physician. And still no one stepped in to get physicians into the facility. So that's just an example of kind of these regulatory gaps creating chaos during the pandemic.
So why didn't anyone step in? What explains that?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I think, you know, if we're looking at Washington State, public health responsibilities really focused at the county level. And so everything has to go through the county. But the county doesn't necessarily have the resources to help. They're more sort of acting as a go-between with state and federal agents. And so when it comes to a situation where help is required immediately, you know, that day, it can't wait, there's a bit of confusion about who's meant to provide care. When it came to getting help to Life Care, there were just failures on many different fronts. I mean, pretty soon after an outbreak was declared at the facility, a third of staff went out sick. And this created a huge staffing shortage. Life Care wasn't able to bring in other workers because they were sick. And temporary workers who worked for agencies in the area wanted nothing to do with a COVID-infected nursing home. The county said it wasn't its responsibility to provide backup care. Apparently, one of the health officers kind of asked around at nearby hospitals for any doctors who were available. Nobody stepped in. LifeCare's parent company wanted to bring in nurses from other states where they had facilities, but Washington doesn't allow nurses licensed in other states to practice within its borders. LifeCare asked Washington State to make an exception, given that this was, you know, an incredibly chaotic situation, and Washington State would not make an exception. So the state then failed to provide assistance, and it took, you know, about 5 days for federal backup to arrive.
Today we are speaking with journalist Katie Engelhart, and she wrote a very lengthy, important piece for the California Sunday Magazine called What Happened in Room 10, and you can find it at yourcallradio.org. If you have any questions for Katie about what she found, or if you have any stories to share about nursing homes and COVID, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Let's hear from Art in San Francisco. Hi, Art. Welcome to the show.
It's such a huge crisis in this country. It's not just in Washington State. It's all over the country. And I think the stats are that maybe 40% of the deaths in our country due to COVID have been in nursing homes. I am a member of the Gray Panthers, and we've been very concerned about this. We've been active in contacting our members of Congress, and we'd like your listeners to know about that. If you could post the information, we'd be very grateful, because the for-profit model seems to be at the root of this problem, and there needs to be a massive investigation and solutions that for reform and ultimately the replacement of nursing homes that are really making a lot of money and are very clever about hiding how they do it. So my question for Katie Engelhart, and thank you for your journalism, Katie, is what, from everything you've seen in the nursing homes, what do you think would be helpful? What areas of reform or replacement of nursing homes do you see that would be necessary to improve the situation? Because this has been going on. It preceded the COVID crisis, and the COVID crisis has only made it worse. Thank you.
Thank you, Art.
Yeah. Thanks. You know, I'm glad that you brought up this issue of the for-profit model and its holes and failings. By 2000, already the nursing home industry in America was a $100 billion industry. So this is quite a large business. We have 70% of nursing homes in America being for-profit. Most are part of large chains. The largest chains are owned by billionaires, Forbes-ranked billionaires. And this is important because what we've seen in academic literature over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years is that these for-profit facilities do tend to cut costs. So Charlene Harrington and a number of other researchers have found that large for-profit chains tend to understaff and tend to have worse patient outcomes when it comes to things like infection control. And they also tend to replace highly skilled staff, so, you know, trained nurses, with, you know, low-skilled, low-wage nursing assistants who aren't trained and aren't able to, you know, provide medical care in the same way. So I think that really matters. And I think right now, you know, what we're seeing is that the nursing home industry is asking for a huge amount of financial relief, something close to $100 billion in financial relief. But we don't really know much about how nursing homes are resourced right now. We don't know if nursing homes are able to cover costs and hire additional staff, because for years we've allowed nursing homes to be incredibly opaque when it comes to financial reporting. The for-profit nursing homes receive billions in public funds every year, and they aren't even required to publish financial statements. So I think we're seeing a lot of calls just as a starting point for more transparency to understand, you know, when we're seeing facilities come down with, you know, have a huge number of resident deaths because there are not enough staff members and because PPE is in short supply, you know, we need to know, actually, could the nursing home have done more with what it had? So I think transparency is a big point. And then I think, you know, infection control is going to get a lot of attention in the coming years. In fact, several months before the COVID hit America, the Trump administration proposed a loosening of infection control regulation at nursing homes so that there wouldn't really need to be any infection control expert on staff. And this is despite the fact that, you know, hundreds of thousands of people die every year of things like influenza. So I think, you know, infection control is going to be really important.
Wow. Well, thank you for that question, Art. We will, excuse me, we have some air quality issues here, Katie, because of our fires, and every day is very different. But today is actually thicker than I expected, so sorry for the coughing. We have done shows about this, but we need to do another show just about the transparency that you talk about and the changes that are needed. One more thing that you point out in your piece that's I think needs more attention is you write that in July 2017, 7 months after the American Healthcare Association first wrote to Donald Trump, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services made sweeping changes to the way that nursing homes are fined for harming and endangering their residents in a manner that saved the industry nearly $50 million in penalties in just 18 months. Tell us more about what you learned about this.
So I think, you know, I've to be clear, you know, the issues with nursing homes precede the Trump administration. And I spoke to one long-term care ombudsman who said, look, we don't fare well under any administration. This administration is a little worse. But what we saw in 2016, actually, when President Trump was elected, he was then president-elect, we saw the nursing home industry really kind of throw its full support behind him and start to make some pretty sweeping requests for change. So the nursing home and the main lobby group, the nursing home administration, wrote to President-elect Trump and referred to existing regulation as burdensome and requested, you know, relief and relief really in the forms of a reduction in financial penalties for things like harming and endangering residents. And President Trump enacted those changes, those requested changes, pretty soon after arriving in Washington. And so we saw that, you know, previously nursing homes were fined for each day that they were harming or endangering a resident. So say a resident had, you know, was getting incorrect medication, the nursing home would be fined for every day that that was happening. Under the Trump administration, the fines were cut so that a nursing home would only be fined once. It might, you know, mess up a resident's medication for 7 days or 3 months, but it would only be fined once for it. And that sounds like kind of a complicated and small sort of change, but actually it did save the industry just huge amounts of money in fines. And, you know, I think the fines themselves are controversial, but certainly a lot of advocates told me that, you know, this has been a problem because it just disincentivizes change, and the fines have become so small, they argue that, you know, for the big chains, it's not even really worth it to fix the problem. Mm.
Well, let's go to another caller. Let's go to Heidi in Oakland. Hi, Heidi. Welcome to the show.
Hi. So my question is about how LifeCare is not providing adequate information to family members on how they are reporting COVID stats. I have a family member who's in a LifeCare facility in Florida where the residents only need to be tested. I'm sorry, the staff only needs to be tested every 2 weeks. And I had been getting weekly or biweekly updates on how many staff members and residents had positive tests. But I had questions on how they were reporting the numbers. And when I called the LifeCare number that comes with these text messages, the person gave me a reference number. This was August 6th, told me, if you haven't heard anything back from LifeCare to explain this, call us back by August 20th. And so far, I've received no call back. So I'm just kind of curious, after this fiasco in Kirkland, why LifeCare still doesn't seem to be very forthcoming to family members about what they're doing with testing COVID cases in their nursing homes.
Yeah, well, I'm really sorry to hear about that. It's certainly something that I heard from family members and residents in Kirkland. You know, I think there was a real breakdown in communication when this happened. In the case of Kirkland, we saw families who just couldn't get through at all to a nurse and ended up gathering outside, sometimes holding huge whiteboards up to the window in the hope that staff or family would see it. You know, there was a woman outside of Kirkland who held up a whiteboard, a big sign asking for nurses to please take her husband's temperature. Another man held up a big sign telling his father, you know, trying to explain to his father why he wasn't visiting him. They just couldn't get through. And I think that has been a huge failing at a number of nursing homes. And I think one really heartbreaking thing that I learned in my reporting was that residents living in the nursing homes weren't always given information. So we had situations where, you know, a resident was, you know, lying in her room and really had no idea what was happening. All of a sudden, nurses are wearing masks. All of a sudden, people are rushing down the hallway. You know, people are being moved from room to room. A resident might notice that her son and daughter hadn't come to visit on their normal day, would really have no idea why. And one staff member at Kirkland told me she really wishes she'd found some way to slow down and explain to residents, let them know about the virus, let them know what was happening. Instead, a lot of residents were left just having no idea what was going on around them. And, you know, there are things that people don't think about when it comes to, you know, the particular difficulties of sharing information in nursing homes. So, for instance, I learned
and that, Katie, we only have about 30 seconds left.
You know, we're left in confusion because no one had changed their hearing aid batteries. The nurses had forgot to do it because they were so overwhelmed by COVID. And so people are lying in their rooms, maybe being spoken to, maybe seeing news on TV, but not really able to comprehend it just because their hearing aids hadn't been properly turned on. Mm. So I found that to be particularly heartbreaking. And I think you're right, too, that testing has continued to be a problem at life care facilities and others. I spoke to a number of nurses who worked at Kirkland for months at the height of the outbreak and were never once tested.
Wow. Well, Heidi, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. Katie, thank you for your reporting, and we will definitely do another show about this. Katie Engelhardt is a reporter and documentary film producer. You can read her piece, What Happened in Room 10, at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.